He was abandoned at birth, mocked for the color of his skin, given 6 months to live after a brutal cancer diagnosis. And yet, he didn't just survive. He rose. Winston Foster, known to the world as King Yellowman, broke every rule and every boundary in Jamaican society to become the first international superstar of dancehall. In a world that saw him as a curse, Yellowman turned ridicule into rhythm, pain into poetry, and stigma into superstardom. This is not just the story of a man. It's the story of rebellion, survival, and redemption carved into the sound system culture of Jamaica and echoed across the world. This is the untold history of King Yellowman, the albino rebel who redefined dancehall. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Abandoned and marked. The year was 1956, and the humid streets of Kingston, Jamaica, moved with rhythm, ska, mento, the distant rattle of dominoes. But for one newborn baby, there was no welcome home. Winston Foster came into the world marked by something he never chose: albinism. His skin was pale, nearly white, a stark contrast to the dark tones of the island around him. And in a society where color wasn't just seen but ranked, where beauty, worth, and even humanity were weighed by skin tone, that difference would define him. His parents didn't take him home. They left him at Maxfield Park Children's Home, one of Jamaica's oldest orphanages, a holding pen for the unwanted, the broken, and the inconvenient. From day one, Yellowman was an outsider. But not just any outsider. He was the other. In Jamaican folklore, albinos were often considered cursed, harbingers of bad luck, or worse, omens of death. Kids like Winston weren't just teased, they were feared. And fear bred cruelty. Inside the home's fading yellow walls, where bunk beds creaked and mosquito nets sagged like tired prayers, young Winston was bullied relentlessly. His peers called him names, Duppy White Boy Freak. Caregivers looked at him with discomfort, never quite hiding their unease. Even the sunlight seemed to mock him, burning his sensitive skin while other boys ran barefoot in the yard. In a country built on resistance and pride, he had no shield, no identity, no name that spoke of power. But even in that bleak silence, something stirred in him, a quiet kind of rhythm, not the kind that comes from drums or guitars, but the kind that lives deep in the bones. Words, rhyme, rhythm, survival. He began to talk back in ways that didn't get him punished, by twisting insults into jokes, turning pain into punchlines. His voice became a shield, and soon a sword. It wasn't yet music, not yet art, but it was the early spark of rebellion. Even as a child, he learned something no classroom ever taught. If you speak fast enough, loud enough, with enough style, you can stop people from laughing at you and make them laugh with you. Or even better, make them listen. But that didn't stop the daily trauma. He would carry the scars of those years for life. Scars of rejection, identity confusion, and emotional starvation. Yet from that same place of abandonment came the seed of something unstoppable: resilience. Before he was Yellowman, before the world knew his voice, he was just a boy with no one and nothing. But his silence would not last forever. Because somewhere in Kingston, the sound systems were warming up, and Winston Foster's name, the one no one celebrated at birth, was about to echo louder than anyone imagined. The voice that couldn't be silenced. By the time Winston Foster reached his teenage years, he had mastered the art of invisibility. Not by choice, but by necessity. In the crowded dormitories and dusty schoolyards of Kingston, he learned to shrink his presence to avoid the sting of fists and words. Yet inside him, something else was growing, something louder, something rebellious. It began with a whisper in his mind, a rhythm in his chest, a rhyme on his tongue. He started stringing words together, flipping insults into verses, transforming isolation into something sharp, something musical. In Jamaica, words are currency, in patios, in preaching, in politics, and Winston had learned how to spend them wisely. Where others cursed his existence, he turned it into a performance. But he needed a stage. In the 1970s, Kingston was alive with the pulse of sound systems, massive mobile speaker setups that brought music to the people. These street parties, often held in rough neighborhoods, were where careers were made and legends born. The mic was a battlefield, and only the sharpest tongues survived. Here, the DJ wasn't just a voice, he was a warrior, a commentator, a prophet. And Winston, now calling himself Yellow Man, wanted in. At first, the ridicule followed him onto the stage. "Why is this duppy man Depon D. Mike?" some would shout. But then he opened his mouth, and everything changed. Yellow Man's voice wasn't just good, it was electric. His flow was unmatched, his wit ruthless, his patois precise. He wasn't trying to sound like anyone else. His delivery was raw, his punchlines dirty, his presence unforgettable. While others spoke in polished tones, Yellow Man barked, taunted, seduced. He made people laugh, gasp, dance, and sometimes shake their heads in disbelief. But no one ignored him. And that's when it happened. The crowd began to cheer. He started earning slots with big-name sound systems like Aces International and King Sturgav. He battled the best, Josie Wales, Brigadier Jerry, Fathead, and held his ground. He wasn't just surviving in the lion's den, he was becoming the lion. For a boy who'd been told he would never belong, this was salvation. Yellow Man had found his pulpit, his purpose, and his people. But even as he rose, he never forgot the sting of rejection. It lived in his lyrics, biting, unapologetic, always pushing boundaries. He turned pain into parody. And in a culture that had tried to exile him, he forced his way into the spotlight. Still, the battle was far from over. Jamaica was listening, yes, but was it ready to embrace him fully? Would the world see past the skin, the stigma, the slackness to recognize the genius underneath? Yellow Man didn't wait for approval. He wasn't here to ask permission. He had the mic now, and he intended to speak his truth, no matter who flinched. Clash of cultures, slackness versus society. By the early 1980s, Yellow Man had become more than just a dancehall DJ. He was a cultural lightning rod. His rise came at a time when Jamaican society stood at a crossroads. On one side were the elders, steeped in Rastafari, roots reggae, and messages of upliftment. On the other were the ghetto youth, tired, angry, hungry, and ready for something more raw, more immediate. Into that fire walked Yellow Man, armed with nothing but a microphone and lyrics that would either liberate or offend. And he chose offense. Yellow Man's style, slackness, was bold, obscene, sexually charged, and unapologetic. He spoke openly about sex, desire, and female anatomy with a raunchy charisma that both thrilled and scandalized his audiences. Tracks like Mad Over Me and Yellow Like Cheese were laced with innuendo and double meanings, turning taboo into entertainment. For many Jamaicans, especially the youth in the inner cities, this wasn't vulgarity, it was truth. It was catharsis. It was freedom through laughter. But not everyone agreed. The establishment, religious leaders, government figures, and middle-class gatekeepers, were appalled. Yellow Man's lyrics were seen as a threat to public morality. His very existence challenged the country's sense of order. An albino orphan from the ghetto, now standing center stage, daring to speak about sex, power, and pride? Unthinkable. Politicians condemned him. Churches boycotted him. Some radio stations refused to play his music. Yellow Man didn't flinch. In fact, he got bolder. He saw himself not just as an entertainer, but as a mirror, reflecting the underbelly of Jamaican life. His lyrics, though outrageous, spoke to a truth many lived but few dared to express. Poverty, sexuality, shame, and resistance were all part of his arsenal. He became the people's poet of provocation, speaking for those silenced by politeness and respectability. And then, the world started to notice. After winning the Tasty Talent Contest in 1979, Yellow Man exploded onto the international scene. His magnetic performances, fearless lyrics, and sheer audacity caught the attention of Columbia Records, making him the first dancehall artist to sign with a major US label. He wasn't just making music, he was building a movement. The sound of slackness was now global. But with fame came even fiercer judgment. Some labeled him a clown, a shame to Jamaican music. Others called him a revolutionary. Either way, he couldn't be ignored. Yellow Man knew what he was doing. He once said, "They never expect someone like me to reach this far. So me haffy go further than dem all." He wasn't just breaking rules, he was rewriting them. In an island torn between roots and rebellion, tradition and tension, Yellow Man had chosen his side. And it was loud, lewd, and impossible to silence. Zoon Goo Zoon Goo Goo Zoon Goo Zane. In 1983, a song hit the streets of Kingston with a name that sounded like a tongue twister, a riddle, a rhythm all its own. It didn't make logical sense, but it didn't have to. Zoon Goo Zoon Goo Goo Zoon Goo Zane was vibe made audible, hypnotic, raw, and unforgettable. With that track, Yellow Man didn't just make a hit, he made history. The title alone was an echo, a chant that would ripple across cultures and generations. The rhythm was built on the Diseases instrumental by Jamaican producer Henry Junjo Laws, and it was both minimalist and infectious. Over it, Yellow Man danced with words, part freestyle, part mischief, part manifesto. The way he rode the beat was surgical, slipping in and out of double entendre, teasing the line between storytelling and seduction. Zungu Zungu Gugu Zungu Zane became an anthem in the dance hall. But it didn't stay there. The rhythm traveled, crossing borders without a passport. From the underground dance hall scene, it leapt into hip hop. KRS-One sampled it. The Notorious B.I.G. flipped it in respect. Tupac Shakur, Black Star, and Sister Nancy all tapped into its sonic DNA. What Yellow Man had unleashed in Kingston was now being repurposed in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, in studios from Tokyo to London. Without even trying, he had created one of the most sampled rhythms in modern music history. But beyond the sound was the symbolism. Yellow Man, the albino orphan who once wasn't even accepted on his own block, was now being imitated by the world's most influential artists. His cadence, his flair, his fearlessness, they weren't just copied, they were canonized. He became the blueprint. Back home, however, the attention brought new pressure. Yellow Man was no longer just a dancehall DJ, he was an international brand. He toured across Europe, the US, and Asia. Fans chanted his lyrics, without even knowing what they meant. His shows were wild, energetic, almost theatrical. And he gave them everything, sometimes two, three shows a night, grinning through the fatigue, through the whispers, through the weight of being Jamaica's first global dancehall export. But not everyone was cheering. In Jamaica, dancehall was still fighting for legitimacy. Yellow Man's critics, many from the older reggae establishment, accused him of lowering the bar. They clung to Bob Marley's roots and righteousness, while Yellow Man brought slackness, sex, and swagger. It was the clash of eras, consciousness versus controversy. Yellow Man didn't care. He never wanted to be Marley. He didn't preach from Mount Zion. He spat truth from street corners. His music wasn't about perfection. It was about survival. And survival would soon take on a far more personal meaning. Because just as Yellow Man's career reached its peak, just as his name echoed in clubs and record stores around the globe, life threw him a curve he couldn't freestyle past. The cancer curse. He was invincible. Or so it seemed. By the mid-1980s, Yellow Man stood on top of the world. The first true dancehall superstar, selling out shows, recording non-stop, and blazing a trail where none had existed before. His pale skin, once a target of ridicule, now gleamed like armor under stage lights. His voice moved crowds, his swagger was unmatched, and his image, the grinning, raunchy king of slackness, was larger than life. And then it came crashing down. At the height of his fame, Winston Foster received a diagnosis that felt like a death sentence, jaw cancer. The irony was brutal. His mouth, the very thing that had made him a star, the source of his defiance, his rhythm, his power, was now under attack. The doctors gave him 6 months to live. The media reported it. Promoters canceled bookings. Fans wept. And for a moment, the unstoppable Yellow Man fell silent. He disappeared from the stage, slipping into the sterile coldness of hospitals and surgeries. He underwent extensive operations, including the removal of part of his jaw. The face the world had come to know, already a canvas of scars, rejection, and rebellion, was now permanently altered. For a man who had been judged all his life based on how he looked, the disfigurement was another cruel twist. And yet he survived. Not just physically, spiritually, emotionally, artistically. When Yellow Man returned to the public eye, he did so scarred, but not broken. His smile was different, but his fire burned even hotter. He stepped back onto stages not as a man restored, but as a man transformed. The cancer didn't kill the king, it revealed something deeper than swagger. It revealed grit. For audiences who had once laughed at his slack lyrics, there was now reverence. For critics who dismissed him as a gimmick, there was awe. He had outlived the slurs. He had outlived the system. And now, he had outlived death itself. His music didn't stop, it evolved. Songs like Blueberry Hill and Strong Me Strong spoke not only of rhythm, but resilience. His performances became more intense, more spiritual. Every lyric, every note, every motion on stage was a message, I am still here. And while others might have recoiled from the spotlight in the face of illness and disfigurement, Yellow Man leaned into it. His face, no longer perfect by any standard, became a symbol of survival. He performed without shame, without fear. he reclaimed his narrative, not as a victim, but as a veteran of life's cruelest battles. In a genre defined by bravado, Yellow Man had found something even more powerful, vulnerability without defeat. But the journey wasn't over, because beyond pain lies purpose. And the man who had once shocked the world with his slackness was now about to shift the conversation, both in music and in message. From slackness to consciousness, Yellow Man had survived everything: childhood abandonment, societal rejection, brutal bullying, and a deadly battle with cancer. But now, in the quiet aftermath of his greatest trial, a different transformation began. It wasn't loud. It wasn't raunchy. It was a slow, deliberate shift, one that few saw coming. The king of slackness, the man once known for his explicit lyrics and irreverent stage presence, was changing. Something in him had evolved. Perhaps it was fatherhood. Perhaps it was age. Perhaps it was the deep spiritual clarity that brushes against a man when he's faced death and lived to talk about it. Whatever it was, Yellow Man was no longer interested in just shocking people. He was ready to uplift them. In the 1990s and early 2000s, a new Yellow Man began to emerge. One whose lyrics shifted from lust to love, from jest to justice, from noise to meaning. He didn't abandon dancehall, he reimagined it. He returned to the roots of reggae, the kind his predecessors like Bob Marley and Burning Spear had cultivated, blending messages of spirituality, resilience, and black pride into his music. Songs like Jamaica Nice, Strong Me Strong, and Prayer revealed a man reflecting deeply, not only on his journey but on the world around him. He spoke of faith, family, and healing. He began advocating for cancer awareness, visiting schools, and encouraging youth to stay away from violence. His stage performances remained high energy, but the energy was different, not sexual, not rebellious, reverent. To longtime fans, this transformation was jarring. Where was the raunchy Yellow Man who dominated the dancehall clashes? But to others, especially a new generation raised on both dancehall and roots, this evolution was inspirational. It proved that artists could grow, mature, and still remain powerful. Yellow Man had transcended the box he was placed in. He had once been seen as a novelty, an albino anomaly with a dirty mouth. But now, he was something far greater, a survivor, a healer, a messenger. And this evolution wasn't about image, it was about legacy. He no longer needed to prove himself. He had already built the foundation for modern dancehall. Artists like Buju Banton, Shabba Ranks, Beanie Man, and even American rappers like Biggie Smalls owed part of their sound and their boldness to Yellow Man's blueprint. The world had caught up to the style he helped create. Now he was setting a new example, that even in an industry obsessed with youth and shock value, dignity and depth could still command attention. Yellow Man had turned his curse into a crown. But there was still one final chapter to write, one that looked beyond the music, beyond the stage lights, to examine what he truly left behind. Rebel royalty, the legacy of King Yellow Man. In the story of Caribbean music, few names carry the weight, the scars, and the triumphs of King Yellow Man. His legacy is more than a catalog of hits. It's a revolution etched into rhythm, a legacy built not on perfection, but on defiance, survival, and transformation. Yellow Man didn't just make music. He shifted the culture. He was the first to prove that dancehall could reach the world, that the sound born in Jamaican street corners and through blown-out speakers could resonate in clubs from London to Tokyo. Before the world knew Beanie Man or Sean Paul, before Shabba Ranks took slackness to the Grammys, there was Yellow Man, blazing a trail through prejudice and poverty with a mic in his hand and fire in his voice. But his true impact was deeper than sales or sound. Yellow Man broke social barriers. In a country where skin tone shaped destiny, he stood tall as a pale-skinned, albino black man in a black nation that feared and rejected him. He took that rejection and made it his platform. He became a symbol of otherness turned power. His unapologetic presence redefined what it meant to be a Jamaican icon. He was not the clean-cut ambassador of roots reggae. He was raw, unfiltered, unashamed. And yet, that rawness became his strength. He made space for misfits, outcasts, rebels, people society tried to silence. He showed them they could not only speak, but lead. And even more powerful was how he evolved. Most stars flame out. Yellow Man adapted. He moved from shock value to spiritual value, from explicit slackness to uplifting consciousness, proving that an artist's greatest act is not their debut, but their rebirth. Today, traces of Yellow Man are everywhere. In the cadence of modern dancehall, in the sampled rhythms of global hip-hop, in the unapologetic boldness of new Caribbean artists who dare to be different. His rhythms have been flipped by rap royalty. His name is whispered with reverence in studios and sound clashes alike. But beyond all that, his story endures because it reminds us of something simple yet profound. That greatness can come from the margins. That scars can be turned into strength. That a voice once silenced can become the anthem of a generation. Yellowman was never supposed to make it, but he did. And in doing so, he redefined not only what a dancehall star could be, but what a king really is.